Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Two different conversations on this podcast, two guests, and both I think you're going to find very interesting. We start with Kenny Mayne, the longtime SportsCenter anchor, now back on the East Coast, although, as we discussed, he's really bi-coastal, but doing the 11 p.m. SportsCenter. And Kenny Mayne is somebody who a lot of you grew up with generationally. He's been at ESPN since 1994. He's had a really interesting career, totally untraditional, from Main Street to Kenny Mayne's wider world of sports. And we discuss his arc at ESPN, whether one can be irreverent. And then he has been somebody who has gotten pretty active politically on social media. And I think you're going to really enjoy that part of the conversation, just how a prominent ESPN anchor approaches that. And he was pretty honest about how he feels about things. And so I think that's an interesting conversation. He's also, you know, Kenny Mayne is very funny, and that conversation just went in 60 different places. So that in itself. And plus, he got cash during the podcast. That's a first. The person actually going at the ATM and getting cash. Second guest is Ed Cunningham, who revealed to the New York Times on August 30th that he was walking away from college football. He could no longer be a cheerleader for the sport. Could not in good conscience be an analyst and watching people in that sport get hurt and suffering injuries that would likely impact them long after their athletic career was over. So we had an interesting conversation on why he walked away and whether he thinks he is a broadcast outlier or whether he thinks others will follow in his path. So I think you're going to find that interesting. Kenny Mayne and Ed Cunningham coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, and we bring in, as I said at the top, Kenny Mayne. He is I believe his official title is SportsCenter anchor. He joined ESPN, as my notes here say, in May of 1994. So if you are a sports fan, you have grown up with Kenny Mayne, basically, depending on what your age is. I guess if your age is 80, you didn't necessarily grow up with Kenny Mayne. But as a general rule, you have seen Kenny Mayne on ESPN for most of your lifetime. He was based on the West Coast for a long time. He is now back in Connecticut, and he joins us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Kenny Mayne, how are you today?
This will be on Community Access.
Yes, this
will. No, you know what? You have most of that right. I'm still living in Seattle, and I live in Connecticut. I work here mostly, but I sometimes might work there, but my daughter's out there. And so when this whole new deal came up and was proposed to me, I was about to get married, and the girl I like lives back here. My daughters are out west. There's a lot on the table. I actually asked Skipper, John Skipper, did you know all this? Like, was I tricked here? And he said, no, I knew you had your fiance, but I didn't know the dynamic. I didn't know every last piece of information. We just wanted you to come back on and do more sports centers, but it had to be back in Connecticut. But it's working for me because I get to see Gretchen when I'm working and some extra days, and then she ships out to Seattle, and I have my daughter the other time. So I have sort of a scattered life, but it's the one I chose.
All right, I didn't know any of that. That's interesting. What, you know, we right before we formally taped this, you mentioned that you are coming off as we tape. We're taping this on a Tuesday. I'm sorry, September 5th, and you are coming off doing the late SportsCenter. Which basically puts you out of the building at like 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:30. So I guess my first question, and I wouldn't have planned this before you told me this, but is it odd to work like late at night in sports media? Do you enjoy it? Because it's not most of your colleagues are working normal hours, yet you're doing something so late at night, and then you land back in your home at like 3:30, and it must be just tough to come down. You must be wired after working.
It all depends on what led into it, you know, what you might have done the day before. Sometimes you're so tired you just go home, crawl in, and you're asleep in 10 minutes. Other times you flip around channels and whatnot. But it's funny, that show, the one you're describing, that's the one we all aspired to in the old days. You know, Stuart and Rich and Trey and all of us, Pito, everybody and their mother wanted to be on that late show because it's the one that in the old days used to repeat all the way till 1 o'clock. And it wasn't for being, you know, like your ego of being on TV that long, but it was good for you for a number of reasons. If you did well, you know, the bosses saw you more, advertisers saw you more, whatever it was that might have profited us. So, and then as you get older, you're like, I want to do earlier shows because I really don't want to be this old staying up till 3 and 4 in the morning. It just, it does beat up your body. It feels like you've been in a boxing match sometimes. I don't do those as often. I'm supposed to be on the one that starts at 11 East and ends at midnight, and then Van Pelt takes over. And by the way, he gets done at 1 and sometimes slightly later. So, I mean, he's kind of working a late night. The good part about it is all the sports are just wrapping up. So, like, you know, in basketball season, Steph Curry just hit a three-pointer and they run it in the room, and that electricity of it just happening, and you're, you know, reacting to it or interviewing somebody about it. Because even though people don't think that I care, I really do. And second, I'm probably a little more of a sports nerd than I give off, but I'm also not a statistical sports nerd. I usually make up off memory when I cite facts that have been handed to me. But I think that there's a fine line of differentiation on that. But I definitely still get a thrill out of a great game or something that just happened, the immediacy of it. But I'd probably get the same thrill if it were straight news and I were just reacting to something that had just happened too, which is what I originally had hoped to be doing.
This is a question that when I knew you were going to be a guest on the podcast, and this is something we've been talking about for a long time, getting you on, so I'm happy you're here. And there's very few people who could really give specifics on this. So please, I'm just going to shut up after I ask it and go as long as you wish. But in as specific terms as you can you let listeners know how the 11 p.m. SportsCenter today for someone in your position is different than, say, 1997 or 2000?
Well, I mean, the biggest difference is back then people didn't have access to all the information. Unless you had an Associated Press wire machine at your apartment, you know, how the hell did you know what happened between the Astros and the Cubs? So we were, or if you lived in that city, or you got a phone call from your friend in that city, right? There were very few means with which to know what in the world had happened in the world of sports. Now, of course, we all have it at our fingertips, but I'm sorry, I thought you just went away. We'll just edit for effect there and make.
No, we leave it. We leave it all in, including
well,
the screw up. So it's great.
The call that's coming in, I believe, is National Rental Car, because I was driving to work. I was just about to on Monday, and there was like, it looked like a bullet hole in the back of my windshield. I don't think that's what happened. I think it was just defective glass. I slammed the door and the glass broke. So they're bringing me a new car. That's a side story. The difference is, yeah, the readily available information. But I don't think, I would argue that that doesn't destroy what we do, because if you like Scott Van Pelt, he's going to describe the day in sports his way. If you like me or you hate me, I'm going to do it kind of the way I do it. And that goes for everybody down the line at ESPN, Jamel and Michael. They're going to do it their way. And each group or each individual kind of has his or her or their, you know, take, and this is like, there's a whole bunch of funny comedians, right? So if you said, oh, I already saw a comedian, I don't need to see more comedy, well, that would say that you can't distinguish between Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld, or, you know, so there's different ways to kind of take in the information. So I don't think by any means that it discarded and discounted what SportsCenter still does. The difference is just that we were, in those days, for the first time on earth, you were hearing that the Cubs beat them, whoever the hell they beat. I remember when I got hired, I don't know why I tell you this now, I told him, I still don't know who the fifth pitcher on the Cubs is, and I really don't care, but if you tell me to do a story on the son of a bitch, it'll be a good story. It was an old Cubs reference.
Do you,
but yeah, that's it. I mean, and things, I don't know. I mean, when I grew up, we had three channels, plus channel 11 and 13, and we had five or six channels. You know, now there are 990 channels, a lot of choices. So back in those days, there were fewer choices. Cable had been around for 20 years or whatever, but you know, relatively, you know, compared to the Ice Age, it was certainly new. You know, it was a newer thing that, oh, cool, Dan and Keith are going to do this thing where they talk about sports, you know. And it had its luster for that reason, because it was so unique. You know, CNN had a show, they had, right? They did their 11 o'clock. And before that, George Michael's Sports Machine. And,
right.
You know, so there were some doing it, but certainly ESPN got the jump start. And then when it cultivated these unique personalities to do it the way they did it, you know, it became kind of a thing. People, hey, I need to get home and watch the 11 o'clock Sports Center or the Late Show. We hoped, those of us that were doing the Late Show.
Kenny, have you, in terms of how you write your scripts for an 11 p.m. Sports Center today in 2017, is it different than how you might have 5-10 years ago?
I don't think in the least. I mean, I think I write less. If you notice, if you go back to the kind of the chronology of how SportsCenter Remember, we used to have a tease at the top of the show.
Right.
Coming up on SportsCenter, will the Cubs win their ninth? I don't know why I keep using the Cubs. but the Mariners, will the Mariners win their 20th straight? And we do all these questions. Will this happen? Will that happen? It was called a tease that drew you in, allegedly. And then, you know, things have changed. And now we just, boom, SportsCenter's on, hey, here's a home run. You know, like, we just get to it. And I think that's a better model anyway. And probably they're like, where are we pretending people don't know or need to have a question answered about will such and such have happened by the time the show airs that much later? But so we just don't do physically as much writing or typing. We used to write all the score panels to every game. We'd be up there 9 minutes before the show putting in. That's the 13th time that Griffey has homered in consecutive, you know. So now it's a lot more is handed to us. Like, the researchers do a great job. They'll give us the statistical background. You know how they'll be like a highlight. We have different names for what the hell the graphics is called. The DU is one of them, whatever that stands for. And it'll be some fancy-ass graphic with a picture of the guy or the girl, and then, you know, drift over, you know, with the jib camera, right? You know what I'm talking about, the little fancy graphic-y thing?
Yep.
So they'll, more often than not, they hand us, we can revise it if we want. More often, I freelance my revisions, you know, like, all there's just a bunch of stats. So I can, in the moment, read what he or she wrote for me and kind of do it my way without, you know, a great deal of effort. But as far as the writing, you know, if there's a serious story to write, or if there's a lead into a big game that, you know, seemingly matters more than the ones that just go direct to video, you know, I don't think hopefully I'm writing better. Hopefully I'm better than I used to be because I'm older and smarter and I've done it before. But I'm not like, oh, don't do that because of this. It's more like I just try to write an interesting or unique little way to get into an event, and hopefully people like it.
As somebody who's been in the middle of SportsCenter for multiple decades, and I'm going to get to your career because it's probably as untraditional a career as one can have. Storied career as one can have at ESPN. But, you know, you have seen publicly competitors bashing SportsCenter as a relic and outdated. There's no argument on this part. The ratings obviously are down from the soaring highs that they were in the 90s and the 2000s. How do you view SportsCenter today in 2017? What is its place for the sports consumer?
I'll tell you to ask for me. It's how I make my money. So it damn well better be important, right?
Right.
Honestly, I think I touched on before where, and I'm not like being company defender here, although I do appreciate ESPN and I would defend ESPN, but it's like I feel like anytime people get asked a question in a similar neighborhood, sounds like you're being an apologist for something. It's like ESPN is still doing very well. And indeed, there are now 970 channels on your cable box. So the landscape is far different. And yes, things aren't climbing in the direction they once did. But that's like saying, like I was pointing out, when I was a kid, just imagine some executive who used to work for NBC in New York in 1963. He's like, son of a bitch, we used to have three channels. We were making so much money. Like, I mean, you just have to face the reality, right? That this is a different landscape. Of course, the numbers aren't going to be the same as they once were, but I don't know. I think our shows are pretty good. So more often than not, you know, if somebody wants to tell me the shows suck, they can say that too. They can say whatever they want. But I think we all in all do a very good job presenting the night in sports, and we do it with great repetition, don't we? Like every single damn night there's another, not just one show, but many, many shows. There's shows you don't even know about that are happening up against games for the people who don't want to watch the game but might want to watch the 9 o'clock SportsCenter on the East Coast. So we do it. It's like a big machine that kicks out show after show after show. And all in all, the thing that I've always appreciated there is the work ethic, that people really care night to night. Each show matters. You know, like don't go out there and mail it in and pretend that nobody's watching because the game's against it, so it doesn't matter what we do. I think we have a good ethic about putting on a good product. I think it still matters. Maybe it doesn't matter in the same way it once did, given that you now have the information. But if you want to sit and you like your sports and you want to sit down after a day at work and, hey, I'm going to watch my hour of sports. This is my time to catch up. What the hell happened with the Kaepernick sign? No, he didn't. Or, you know, did the Mariners win again? They lost. There you go. Like, I mean, you could say the same thing about nightly news. You know, I still think nightly news matters, the 6 or 6:30 evening news or the cable channels, when it's also true. I could go to Twitter and already find out what so-and-so said or what law was passed or what decree was made, right? We could have all that information before sitting down to watch Lester Holt or whoever it is we like. And in that case, you know, you'd say everything is We've obviated the need for to watch anything. We can just watch Twitter. But I never go home to watch the Super Bowl on my phone. I'm going to watch it on TV.
Kenny, as someone who's on-air talent, how closely do you pay attention to the day-to-day viewership? Or is that something you leave to the producers and management?
I couldn't tell you the foggiest notion of any statistic related to audience research. Seriously, I don't think I ever – and I, this isn't like I'm being aloof about it. It's just – I try to do well each night and not screw up too many names or yell across the room, how do you say so-and-so? Other than that, I just try to have good shows and go see Gretchen and play with her the next day and come back and do it again. Like, I pay almost no regard to all the math of it because I'm still going to try as hard to have a good show as I was if a billion people were watching or if nobody's watching. If it's just my sister Nancy, you know, like who used to watch me on the Sports Smash ESPN2 in the old days. I certainly hope the numbers are okay, and I hope we're doing well. I'd rather us do well than not well because I work there, so I'd rather us succeed than not. But day-to-day, I'm not like, oh, my God, such-and-such channel's getting this or that rating. It just it doesn't impact me. Like, I'm still going to do my show the way I did it and hopefully do it as well as I can and keep improving. Like, I think I am getting better even at my advanced age. Like, I think I'm getting smarter at how I do things, not to cut corners, but just be more efficient. And use resources a different way and just learn from mistakes. Although I can't say I go back and watch too many shows either. I don't really love watching myself on TV.
That's interesting. Your career at ESPN is...
Storied.
It's storied, right. That's the word. That's not really not the word I was looking for. But it's unique. And that's usually like a crappy word. But in this case, it really is. You had your own web series, Main Street, kind of well before digital series and sports were big. You hosted Kenny Mayne's Wire World of Sports, which was a pretty interesting thing for ESPN to do, and not something essentially anybody else was doing. Marty Smith does a little bit of this now, but nowhere near you were doing it on a global perspective. You were on Dancing with the Stars briefly. I bring up all this resume stuff because I do want to get your answer to the question of do you think what you have done can be duplicated if somebody's joining ESPN now in their late 20s or early 30s? Like, could they have that kind of untraditional path? Or now at ESPN, do you have to be siloed into you're the, you're an NFL expert, you're an NBA expert, you're going to be Scott Van Pelt? That's what's interesting about your career is that there's not really many others who have done the kind of things you've done at this company.
I think I should get a one-time residual payment for all those things you just mentioned. And I appreciate that you brought them up. No, I don't know. I guess, I mean, I would never tell anybody not to aspire to do anything and everything they want. So I wouldn't hold anybody back from trying this or that. But Marty's a great example. I got a friend who I did a lot of that Wider World stuff with, and he's half joking, half serious, like, damn, Marty Smith stole all our budget. You know, because he kind of is doing his version.
Right.
Of what I might or might not. And I love Marty. Marty and I have been friends for a long time. Hopefully he thinks I've been good to him. I remember him coming to me early on. He didn't really know his way around. And I've just liked his work. I love his enthusiasm. I think he does it a different way, his accent, his pretend Southern accent. No, he's solid. I love Marty. But to answer that question, there was no design, I don't think. I can update you. We're getting cash out of the cash machine right now.
Switch. What are the denominations? 20s, 50s, 10s?
We don't have it yet, but I love it when they let you pick if you're going to take
Same here.
Out more.
Yep.
For instance, if you're going to a racetrack or a Las Vegas casino, who wants 20s? It hurts your pants almost. So,
by the way, would you agree that a $50 bill is kind of maybe the most useless currency that we could potentially have? Because cashiers don't particularly like the 50.
No, I'll give you that, but I feel a lot of power. 100 feels a little too ostentatious. You know, you're throwing hundreds around.
Agreed.
50 just feels like you're doing okay. Like you're going to be able to eat this week and you can buy your groceries with a 50. I like using cash more than credit cards. I don't know. My dad always felt like it felt good if you had a certain amount in your pocket.
Right.
And then you're like, although did they even have credit cards back then? They probably did.
You want it to be 1968, basically, historians.
Yeah. I'm going no receipt. Just so you know.
All right. Appreciate
what? An additional fee will be assessed. Okay, fine. Would you like another transaction? No.
All right.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to precisely duplicate what I did, and that's not saying I'm so important. It's just answering your question. Because, I mean, maybe things will change and somebody will get to do five or six things. I guess my hang-up with that is I like everything I did, so even though I would, you know, be knocked out of one thing or they decided not to continue with something, it wasn't like my life was ruined because there was usually something else to go on to. But I sort of, when people ask, which did you like best, doing SportsCenter, doing features, or travel the world, or you left out horse racing, magazine writing?
Yep.
I did those as well.
Yep.
Right now, they've said, what we want from you, you know, they kind of want more widgets. They want more frequency because the argument was, why are we paying him to go off to Switzerland and screw around in flip-flops for 3 weeks to make 1 6-minute story, albeit they might think it was a good one? And we also packaged those into these hour specials that ran on ESPN and ABC. Of course, one of them started at 9:41 Eastern because of a delay of a women's softball game. God love women's softball, but it just kind of, you know, I mean, it wasn't like it was being heavily promoted. Here it is, 8 o'clock, it's on. So I've liked all those things I've done. I kind of wish I could do them all at once because sometimes when I'm doing one of the things I'm doing, I miss the other thing, you know? Like, I miss Seattle when I'm in Connecticut, I guess, in a way. I always miss Gretchen, who's by my side right now.
Nice.
You know, so I think it's one of those things where if you've done a variety of different things, it's easy to kind of be lonesome and homesick for that thing you're no longer doing. And I love doing Main Street. By the way, every damn person on that show made it except for me. Aubrey Plaza, Ben Schwartz, Allison Becker, John Glazer, Lenny Jacobson, who only did a couple roles. Who else? Mulaney. Good God. Every single person on that show went off and made it big in Hollywood. Aubrey's like, you know, ready to take over. She got a picture and covers a magazine.
Wow. What was she, I should know this, but what was her role on Main Street?
Well, it's so funny. Allison Becker and Aubrey Plaza both came in to read. We actually did readings. We were like a legit little fake little TV show that was on the internet. And I thought it turned out pretty well. This is going way back. What is this?
2008.
7, 8, 9, somewhere in there, a couple years. And Allison was great. We're still good friends, as I am with Aubrey as well. Aubrey comes in, just totally different vibe, but so good. Afterward, I was like, we need to just make up a new part for Aubrey. Like, Allison should be the one we thought she was going to be, but we just need to make up an Aubrey part. So she became a fake executive senior leader at ESPN. You know, we gave her some title, vice president of something. And she wasn't in as much as Allison, but she certainly was great when she was in it. And then, you know, they both were on Parks and Recreation, and Aubrey's done a bunch of movies. Allison's done a bunch of commercials, and they were both at our wedding.
Wow. No kidding. Look at you floating in the Hollywood. How long have you and Gretchen been married? This seems like a recent wedding, or am I wrong about this?
All of 5 weeks.
Jesus.
We're in love more each day.
We
fall in love deeper.
She's there now. Wow. By the way, God bless her for listening to your end of the podcast.
She loves pods.
Five weeks. Wow.
July 29, so that's August 20, you know, ish, five. And this is one serious note. I put a small little note on Twitter. We made so many good friends. We got married in the Caribbean, and we honeymooned in a place called St. Bart, which neither of us had ever been to, St. Bart's.
Yep.
And just beautiful spot. The people could not have been nicer. So obviously with the hurricane, another hurricane coming down on them, in the Bahamas as well. Like, obviously we're hopeful that they stay low and it turns out better than it looks.
Absolutely. Wow. So, well, congratulations. 5 weeks. That's a recent wedding. Nice.
Yeah. Honeymoon period.
It is by far the honeymoon period. How do you feel about comedy within the traditional sports networks? It strikes me that I shouldn't sort of just make this overall sort of judgment, though I will, I guess. I don't know how ESPN executives would feel if somebody came in today with your kind of deadpan and irreverence that obviously wasn't known like you were. Do you think somebody with your kind of sense of humor, who's 31, could come in and get the kind of run you got at ESPN today in 2017?
Why are you trying to discourage all these young people from aspiring to grit?
Yeah, that's what this podcast is about. It's not about uplifting. It's about bringing people down.
I hope they all have miserable careers and get stuck doing it. No, I don't know. I mean, believe me, I came in 1994, I had sent a letter. Remember John Walsh, our, one of our exalted leaders, John Walsh,
right.
Famous for kind of reinventing SportsCenter. He worked at Rolling Stone. He had this. He too had a storied career.
Yeah. By the way, once called my boss and told my boss I was an asshole. That's my John Walsh story.
Well,
true story.
Maybe you were.
That's good. Good lie.
I don't know the story behind that, so I'm sure you guys would laugh over it all these years later. What was I trying to say?
You're talking about uplifting, yeah.
Yeah, no, I had sent John Wall. I had freelanced for – I had interviewed with ESPN way the hell back when. Did not get hired because literally John Walsh has asked me about the freaking Chicago White Sox middle relief or something in the interview. It's like I can't name one guy. You know, I don't know if I can today. But it just didn't matter. I kept on like, well, yeah, but on a show you don't get a quiz in the middle of the show. Can you name all the members of the middle relief for the White Sox, right? You have pieces of paper that have names on them, and you try to artfully call highlights, right? I'd already been doing the ESPN model of highlight calling in Seattle, though not as well. But I kind of like, when I saw their system, I was like, shit, I've been doing that. I was already doing that. So I kind of felt like ahead of the game. I kind of know what they're doing now. I see what they do. And then I would watch what they're doing. I was like, I think I could do that. But it didn't happen for me. So they kind of strung me along for like 5 years while I worked various odd jobs in Seattle for having quit a real TV job. Soon after being interviewed by ESPN. Did you catch all that?
Yep.
So I sent John Walsh a letter. Literally, I was at the end of my rope. Like, how long are they going to string me for the rest of my life? Am I going to be selling long distance in Seattle? God love the long distance sellers, but it wasn't for me. It was just kind of like paying the bills. I was still trying to get back into TV, but it was only ESPN that I was trying, which was an unusual path, I know. So I sent John Walsh a letter and said, please, I'm trying to sort out, you know, the direction of my career, please check the appropriate box and mail back. And the first one said, stand by the mailbox, contract is on the way. Next one said, keep doing the freelance work you've been doing. And the third one said, we'll hire you about the time ESPN 5 hits the air. And he literally checked the middle box, you know, keep up the freelance work, and mailed it back. And about a month and a half later, they called me, got him Al Jaffe, who you know, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And I was hired.
So, wow.
By the way, he called on April 1st. I'm like, is this like the most elaborate, like just because I was really committed to wanting to get hired there. And, you know, they would send me out to interview Griffey. I would, in addition, write like essentially an extra credit report. You know, I'd go home and type out, here's the story I would have written had you assigned me to do a story, not just interview Griffey for three questions. So some of them probably thought I was just a lunatic. And others like, wow, that guy's pretty damn ambitious. He really wants to be here. But it took many years to finally get hired. Vince Doria is the one who finally brought me in. But to answer, that was a lot of preamble to say, I don't know. I think I was looked at as quite an oddball by some of them. Then there were others who really liked my different approach. And my different approach isn't like I'm coming out like a clown and putting on new clothes and makeup. And I think it mirrors this conversation, right? Like, I'm not a hell of a lot different on TV, except that I'm in a blue suit and I have to be a little more official and say, you know, statistics and whatnot. But as far as my tenor, it's, you know, the same.
One of the
maybe they didn't like me. Maybe that's the problem. But I survived.
And no doubt. Thrived, I would say, not survived. One of the things about this is a little inside baseball, but people who listen to this podcast, there are certainly some people. Not some, but a lot of people in the business, so they'll know this. One of the things you are really well known for is when ESPN holds its annual upfronts. This is when they make their presentation to media buyers to, here's why you got to buy ESPN this year, because we have all this great programming, all these great people, blah, blah, blah. You historically have always been part of these upfronts. You do like a 3 to 5 minute segment. It usually gets praised as sort of the funniest moment of the upfronts. This is like kind of a little fascinating subworld here, in that you have become known for something that is so kind of like this industry thing, where you come on and do like a couple of minutes of stand-up. You've been asked about this a lot, but here's like a question I wanted to ask you, and I have no idea if you've ever been asked this, but like, do you think that helps?
By the way, this is a longer preamble.
Yeah, I know. This is a shitty question. I'll be the first to admit it. But do you think this helps you, your standing with the executives, in that you are known as someone who could come in and talk to 1,000 media buyers, and they love hearing your segment at this very industry-related thing?
Certainly. They actually wrote it in the new contract says 150 sports centers and the upfronts.
Wow.
That's all that says on it.
Interesting.
So apparently it matters to them. I'm not bragging there. Just you asked the question. But I think I do it halfway well. And I think the difference is I just don't have any fear of failure in it, where some others who might be, you know, they might have an equally funny thing to say or whatever, maybe look at it like that's not their role to go out there and just be ridiculous. And they use the way it started. I can't remember the very first time. I think it was, hey, can you just join on stage for such and such, whatever the first time was. And I cannot recall where it was. And I remember going fairly wildly off script, like the prompter was up there, what they wanted. And I just kind of did some other stuff. So first it was the danger of, oh my God, what's he going to do? He's going to get us all fired. We're going to lose the Nabisco account today, you know, whatever. and then, oh, they laugh. Hey, way to go. Good job. Do that again. So but it's kind of funny. I think in a bit of a way that fear and then the reaction after has kind of been my whole story there. Like, is he going to do something that I've had many producers say, don't get me fired today. Like, that's their opening remark as we meet to do a show. So I don't quite know why anybody really thinks that, because maybe I'm more unconventional than the next guy, generally speaking, but I usually know where the right line is. Like, I can't remember anything where it was a fireable offense. Although this is a funny story separate from the upfronts, which I hope to go back and do well again if they have me. Rob King, who's one of our senior guys, right?
Right.
In the production side, Sports Center side, he was new to the company. I just met him, and next thing you know, he's running the golf event. I used to go to the golf. That's another thing I did. We kind of were leaving out other things. I used to go to all the majors, except for the Masters, which the story pertains to. So at TPC Sawgrass, the last line of whatever the hell story I did, I made some silly remark about join us next time from the Masters when we sneak 4 saucy ladies on the course. You know, imagine what the starter will say. And it was all done, you know, clearly tongue in cheek, just being stupid, because whatever ridiculous story I'd already done, that was kind of like the tag to it. And so Rob King's in charge of this thing. He's in a remote. He's in a trailer somewhere in, you know, in what is it, Tallahassee? Where the hell is it? Not Tallahassee. What am I trying to say? Where is that? Jacksonville. Near Jacksonville, right?
Yep.
TPC Sawgrass. And he literally is getting phone calls from higher executives than him at ESPN and the folks at the Masters. Like, he's not coming to the Masters. You know, like, they took my words literally. And Rob has forever said, that's great. I was there 1 week and you almost got me fired, like my opening thing that I covered. But fortunately, most people can take a joke. It's kind of like with the NFL stories that we used to do. We basically did fake news before it had a name. I would make up out of whole cloth sometimes, just let's make up this story and Tom Brady will have this line and so-and-so will have that line and Aaron Rodgers will have that line. Or we would take a real thing that happened and just kind of go off the deep end with it and kind of make our little parody of reality. And most teams were pretty good. I'd say half the teams got it and knew that, oh, the players like doing something different. You know, it's not the typical how's your defense going to handle the quarterback this week questions. And the funniest part of it was who really bought in and who didn't. And one of my best teams, it was the New England Patriots with Belichick in charge. And I think if you ask that question, like, who did you have most success with? Who was the loosest? They think it would be Seattle because they know me and Holmgren was there. And that was true also. But it was strange that Belichick was a believer. He sometimes would look at the script, strike a line or two, and then pass it back to the Stacey James. All right, fine. The rest of it's fine. So we kind of had needed pre-clearance because I wasn't doing real journalism here. It was like shooting a commercial, essentially, except they weren't being paid.
Right.
So, God, that was a long answer. I didn't know what the question was. It was about upfront. Yes, I enjoyed the upfronts. They seemed to like me. I should get more commercials. Go ahead. I don't have an agent. Call me directly. Thanks.
Oh, nice. Is that true? You don't have an agent?
I've had agents.
But right now, you're your agent. I like that.
I'm never going to have an agent again.
You and John Buchagras share that philosophy, I believe.
Yeah. I think it's great that they work for some people. I think my problem is I'm very controlling about what I want to have happen and how it should happen and what we should be doing. So I never trust anybody enough for 5 minutes to represent me because I would have done it different maybe. Or I'm just not sure it's just an effective means for me to make money. I've who doesn't want to make more money? But we've done well enough doing it the way I'm doing it.
Right.
And there's no way in hell I'm having an agent. Thanks.
I appreciate the honesty there. All right, a couple more here. I should have asked you this regarding the upper. Have you done? I'm sure this isn't a yes, but have you ever walked into a comedy club to do stand-up just for fun? You must have, right?
Oh, you know what? Only once, and it was so long ago, and I sucked so badly.
Wow, surprising.
I think I could, though. I think I could, but I haven't had, like, I kind of get to do that in the things I do. Like, I do a certain number of speaking events every year. You know, whether the upfronts or whether I'm hosting a banquet or sometimes a company will pay you money to go to Las Vegas. And I'd be funny for a half hour and, you know, we're going to hand out insurance awards after that.
Right.
And that stuff is easy. So I don't know. Who knows? I don't know if I'm psychoanalyzing myself. Maybe there's the fear of doing it for real would be harder or it'd be present a greater challenge. Who knows? Maybe I'll take you up on that one. I'll just show up somewhere.
Sweet. Let me know. All right. This is a big segue, but this is pretty interesting to me because you are someone in terms of me, you know, paying attention to your Twitter feed. You have delved into
my account was hacked.
Yeah.
My account was hacked.
Nice. It's a Marshawn Lynch move. You've delved into politics, and you make it very clear on where you stand on certain things. For example, as we're taping this, you've made it clear your thoughts on DACA.
That was happening real time, right?
Exactly. Real time as we're taping this. And so you, I think you've been clear on sort of how you feel about climate control. This is my intro into the fact that you are well aware that this is multifold. Your company has its own feelings on on-air people, front-facing people who talk about politics, particularly when it comes to the president. And then you know that there are a lot of people out there, particularly in conservative media, who want to paint ESPN as a left-leaning organization. That's my long preamble there, to ask you, what's your approach to talking about politics online? And was there some kind of moment in the last couple of years where you decided that you were going to put out there what you believed and damn whatever the consequences are?
God, that's a loaded question. Well, potentially some of the things that happened in advance of the last election and after it, and then what we've seen since.
Right.
I guess that would be my motivation for being more demonstrative. I mean, I've always loved my country. I voted for Reagan twice. I voted for Obama twice. In between, did I vote for Clinton once? Bush, Dole, let me think. I'm trying to remember my vote if I stated.
Dole?
I honestly don't. I think I did not vote for Clinton. My point is, I've gone to both sides. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. You know the song by Jackson Brown, I Am a Patriot?
I am not familiar with that song, but I'll Google it as you're talking to me.
It's a wonderful song. Eddie Vedder covered it as well.
No.
He's basically making the point, like, I go case by case, and I think both parties have failed us miserably. You know, you look at the inaction and just the redistricting so that they can the gerrymandering so they can have safe districts. And, I mean, all of it is corrupt. But I would say this. I think I care more about, like, I said this recently on Twitter, like, within the last 6 months or something. I think we're all going to be judged for what we said and did during these times.
I agree.
Like my children, one's in college and one's in high school, so they already know the truth of it. But let's say you had a little kid 20 years from now. I think they're going to say, what were you saying back then? The best example I can give is if there was somebody in sports, and there's a perfect example, because remember Donald Sterling case, the Clippers owner.
Yep.
Remember how everybody and their mother, it was so easy to be against him, right, because he had this past that had a racist connotation to it, right? His acts. So that wasn't very hard for anybody and everybody. Damn him, I'm so against racism, right? That was an easy one. But for some reason, when it comes to presidential politics or national politics, as though we're not to have any opinion, it doesn't make any sense, right? If there was something going on in sports right now that was just utterly reprehensible and we didn't make commentary on it, that would look kind of strange by itself. So I don't know. I think the key that I stay with is try to be fact-based and not just, like, argue with people and call each other names. And I like civil discussions. I've had a number of pretty civil discussions with people where we clearly were on opposite sides of whatever the point was. and ended up like direct messaging the guy and kind of like, okay, I heard what you're saying. Like, well, we just take this offline. And two people who seemingly are so far apart actually found a way to agree about something and have some commonality about it. But I'm kind of all over the place on my answer, except to say, when I see something out there, if I stay fact-based, like when I hear fake news, I often repeat Central Park 5 and Obama birth certificate.
Yeah,
That was fake news, wasn't it?
I
don't know. I think it's all there to see.
What? Two things off that. What is your? Have you gotten any kind of feedback internally from ESPN people? And what has been your interactions on Twitter with people who probably, and I get this as well, who fundamentally just don't like sports people talking about politics?
Well, I don't understand. For one, why does anybody have a right to tell me what I should do? Like, I don't do Facebook. I don't do Instagram. I don't do Snapchat. What's the other one? I don't do LinkedIn. I keep getting invited, but I just keep erasing it. Even people on
Facebook, LinkedIn. No. LinkedIn isn't a bad thing. Yeah, the others I can understand.
I'm happy for the LinkedIn people. I don't want to get another credit card when I go to whatever, Dick's. I just want to give money and leave. Like, I don't want to sign up for any more stuff. I don't want LinkedIn.
I think Dick's is an ESPN sponsor, by the way, so well done.
I love Dick's Sporting Goods, and I always have. And that's why I pay them cash to help the economy, okay? I don't want the 10% savings. My point was more, I don't want to sign up for more stuff. I get too many damn emails as it is. So all I do on social media is Twitter. And the only reason why I did it originally, I didn't know what it was, but we were doing Main Street, and Ron Wexler, my old boss who's now with NBC, Universal, he's like, you got to sign up for Twitter. It's this new thing. And he's explaining, I didn't know what the hell it was. Like, what do you mean Twitter? What's Twitter? Because remember, at the beginning, it was just weird. The name was weird. Like, we're tweeting. All that stuff was weird. So they signed me up, and I kind of like, over time, like, oh, you know, I'm starting to get it. So I don't think I've written anything, to make a long story short, I don't think I've written anything outrageous that anybody could say, damn him. He just said something crazy, and it was so insulting to this party or this person or anything like that. I think most of I just say real facts, or sometimes I just repeat a story, and it doesn't mean I'm even endorsing it. It just means here's an interesting story. Other people should read it. So
what do you think? Last one on this is what have you, as someone who obviously has been in the business a long time and reads a lot, what have you made of a lot of places, including your competitors, really trying to push this narrative out there that you work for a company that's left leaning and that traffics in political correctness run amok?
Well, here's the thing: you're probably leading to the Robert Lee thing. Had there not been a Nazi and Klan march in that town that was more or less covered for by certain people in the administration, then we wouldn't have had a Robert Lee problem, right?
Right.
Had Charlottesville not happened, or had the president not done what he did afterward, maybe the name Robert Lee would be no big deal. He'd just be another Asian guy calling a game, right?
Right.
The name Lee. No offense to any Asians. Big Asian fan here. So to criticize ESPN for making that decision without the context of the totality of it, of the state of the country and what just happened in Charlottesville, is kind of stupid, right? Because you're looking at a specific, they killed a guy, Robert Lee, he's out now because he has a similar name to that general guy. Like, no, like you have to look at the whole of it. Had he been sent there, he would have been crushed on, oh my God, can you believe how stupid ESPN is? They sent a guy named Robert Lee down to the South, you know, like, so the company was going to lose either way. The best thing would have been to handle it internally, which they tried to do, and shift to another game, and nobody would have had to think the better of it, and life goes on. But I don't know. There's so many different things going on right now. The thing about Kaepernick being blacklisted, you know, there's no way in hell there are 64 better quarterbacks. I don't think there are 32 better, but certainly not 64. So clearly he's being punished for what he did. But yet my Seattle guys, I got guys sitting down before the game. I got Marshawn Lynch sitting down. To me, that one is pretty simple. Like, there's 74,000 people there, whatever the number is, the stadium. If one or two people decide, for whatever political reason, they want to sit it out or kneel it out, go ahead. The flag's strong enough to handle it.
Right.
The Constitution's strong enough to handle it. Everything's going to go on. The flag still played, or the flag still flew, and the song still sung. And I come from a huge singing family. My sisters and my nieces, my daughter sang at her high school. And so the anthem's kind of an emotional thing for me. Like, I remember everyone where they sang, and your heart's beating, and you kind of flash through, you know, what is your country? What's going on? What's the state of the affairs? And I happen to stand for it. So there you go. I must be pro-military because I stand for it. But somebody who sits is not pro-military. They have nothing to do with each other. Like, and if you go even further, the whole thing about where some of that patriotism was sort of paid for, I don't know. I think real acts of patriotism are doing good things in your community, and a whole bunch of these people who are being criticized for being these, you know, outrageous people who are dissing the military for kneeling during the anthem to protest civil rights, you know, that aren't being given out to everyone. It's just such a conflicted and twisted conversation. It would be impossible for us not to have that be a topic bar, right? That's right. Just one, and there are many. So I think it's ridiculous to say they should only give Cubs scores. I'd use the Cubs again. They should only, you know, give AL wild card playoff statistics. Like, I say the same about the athletes. If you think Michael Bennett should only tackle people, I think you're dead wrong. Like, I expect a hell lot more out of Michael Bennett than tackling people. He's a brilliant guy, and his brother as well up in Green Bay.
Yep.
Like, I hope they do a lot more than play football.
And I, as we're talking, I just looked up Jackson Browne. I'm surprised I didn't know this song, I'm a Patriot, also covered by Pearl Jam. And I think maybe prior to Jackson Browne, it might have been Steven Van Zandt who had it.
I don't know if I knew that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. So maybe Jackson is covering.
Learn something new every day. But it's easy to see how that topic can go all over hell and gone. And then somebody, I don't even know what I just said. Somebody could grab one little piece of what I just said and make it sound like I'm way worse than I am if I'm bad.
Absolutely.
Or I'm better than I am if I'm good. So things get taken so far out of context all the time. And Twitter's, you know, one of the people just go in there because they want to yell at each other. And I hate that. Like I said, I rarely engage with people. When I do, it's to correct something, like, you know what, I might have said that poorly. Let me correct. Here's what I meant there. I want to make sure I'm taken clearly. And who the hell am I anyway? I'm just some guy from Kent, Washington. But apparently it feels good. It feels good to kind of like let stuff out. Like, here's my opinion. Here's what I believe in. Like, it's a good platform for that.
I agree with you. I'm you know, there's more. It can be a horrible place, but for me, it's the best news gathering source that still exists. So I'm going to be on there. And like, sure. Yeah, like you, like, and I think we're politically aligned in a lot of stuff. So I'll just sort of, let's just be forthcoming there, but it just sometimes feels good. You just want to have like a public forum where you just sort of say what you believe, and like, you just don't get, you know, you can't do that in your day to day life. But on a place like that, where some people may be, you know, you might have a little bit of an audience. You're right. It just feels good for it. I'm with you on that. That's something.
There's a bit of therapy involved there. Definitely. But I don't know. I think a nice, civil, and free exchange of ideas, that's a great thing. But
yes.
Going back to the whole thing about the anthems and kneeling and what it all means, like peaceful dissent against whatever, whether it's against the president or whether it's what it originally started for, when as we can recall, like, you know, what was going on in our country, why Kaepernick first did it. You know, I'm white. I grew up white, middle class, two parents. Education was pushed. You know, we sat down and watched the evening news from age 8 on, like Walter Cronkite, like, you know, reading the paper. Like, we were well informed, and it was pushed by my parents. Not a direction, you have to think this, but here's information. Start learning. So I don't know what it's like. My dad served World War II. He didn't fight, but he was in the Army at the end of the war right when it was ending. He didn't come back and have to drink from a separate water fountain, all right? So I don't know what it's like to be in a house where I hear stories about my dad who had to drink at a separate water fountain, or my great-great was a slave. Like, I don't know that experience. So I can only empathize with what it's like to see other injustice. And I'd have a pretty thin skin, personally, or a chip on my shoulder. I'd see injustices and be pretty pissed off about it. So I don't see why Kaepernick's just saying, I'm going to make a stand. I'm going to talk about it on the outside. I'm going to do other good works. Like, why is he that? That's patriot. He's a patriot, not a anti-American, right? He's doing something that's speaking up for his position, and he's advocating for it in the way he's advocating it for it, and his right to do. And so all these teams are clearly just scared of the backlash of, oh my God, here comes the guy who doesn't respect the flag. He's, you know, he's going to cause trouble. Like, none of it adds up, and it's all there to see. And I was glad that Aaron Rodgers was very demonstrative about it just recently in the interview with Mina
Kimes on ESPN, the magazine. All right, I want to finish up with this, Kenny, because it leads to our next guest, who's Ed Cunningham. He, of course, walked away from his ESPN college football job. He, to sort of just paraphrase, said that he could no longer go on the air in what is somewhat a promotional role and see players, particularly in college, just getting hurt and potentially doing long-term damage. You're someone who played college football. You're also someone who knows Ed Cunningham. Do you see Ed as an outlier, or could this be it's never going to be the beginning of a mass exodus, but could you see Ed Cunningham as the beginning of other broadcasters sort of under some kind of moral framework just not being able to call football anymore?
I wouldn't predict either way, but the conversation has already been out there because, you know, you've heard other ex-NFL players, ex-college players saying, if I had a child right now, you know, I wouldn't let him play, or her, play until a certain age. Like me personally, I think the way they should be doing it, I don't know why we have six-year-olds tackling each other. Like, what are we doing here? Like, I think they should play flag, controlled scrimmage things all the way up until high school probably. Like, bones aren't even really formed yet, you know? And then the number of concussions you might be getting even at those young ages, the coaching isn't as good. They're not exactly teaching the Pete Carroll wrap-it-up rugby-style tackling technique. I mean, I had coaches that were so stupid, they would withhold water from us as a punishment, okay?
Amazing.
Yeah. So I'm not that old, but in my lifetime, that's how dumb some of the football teaching has been. So we've evolved, and hopefully we're doing a better job taking care of protecting players and treating injuries, although obviously you've seen all this concussion syndrome stuff and the controversy related to that. So I don't think he's the first. He's the first to do it in the way he's done it. And I totally respect his decision. Like, I'm not going to criticize him for, you know, he's facing himself in the mirror saying, I don't know if I can do this anymore. I'm seeing too much damage and all the effects afterward. But football, just one of many dangerous sports. That's the only thing I would say, not counter to his decision, but just to look at it more broadly. There's auto racing. That's kind of dangerous, right?
For sure.
You keep going out. Basketball's even, basketball's a collision sport. Hockey's a collision sport. Baseball.
Soccer on headers. I mean,
soccer,
there's a lot.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, God, we haven't even gotten into extreme sports. So any athletic activity where you're putting your body on the line, there's going to be some price to be paid for certain people who unfortunately unlucky and get injured or do dangerous things. So football's hardly the only one like, oh, my God, we have to outlaw football because it's too dangerous. But I hope all this is – he's like another wake-up call like, hey, let's take – everything. Let's look at the whole thing and be serious and diligent about what we do to protect the players. Better helmets, better techniques, better everything, better treatment, and hopefully it does some good. So I totally respect his decision. I'm still watching the game, but sometimes I shudder. I never look at the replays on the injuries because I broke my leg three different times. I'm still limping from the last one. So I didn't have the concussion issue, but I definitely had the limb issue that bothers me to this day. Wow. Like on SportsCenter, I have sort of like fake dress shoes. They're cut in half, and I just step into them to pretend I'm wearing dress shoes.
Wow, no kidding.
I like to be in flip-flops most of the time.
So not, I know you
better for my ankle.
Specialized schools for specialized shoes for your injuries. Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah. So that's Neil Everett, and I have a running. He went to Oregon, as you probably heard through the way he hypes Oregon or Hawaii.
Right.
But I broke my leg at Oregon playing for UNLV. It was the last play of the game. And some guy stuck his helmet on my ankle, and it was 1980. So I did a story once on Warren Moon being the fumbles leader at the time he was, I think far past him. We pretended that he had to go to James Andrews to get butter removed from his hands. It was one of those pretend stories I was telling about. But having James Andrews in it alone was pretty solid.
Yeah.
And so I talked the girls into some free, by girls, I mean women, some free x-rays. I call women girls, and I don't mean any it's not a put-down. I called Gretchen a girl. So just clearing that one up there so nobody takes that snippet out of it and says something. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah. I like the fact that you think that a lot of people are listening to this podcast enough to take snippets. That's exciting.
We're used to doing these fix shows, so you know when you've made potentially a mistake that might need to get corrected. So I like to fix it in real time and just hope that people are fair enough that they – heard the whole thing. I don't think calling women girls is sexist anyway. It's like it's a familiar, like friendly, hey girls, how's it going? Like that's how it's meant. It's not a put down that you are less than men, because I would call the men boys or guys. Hey boys, guys, fellas, right? Not men. Okay, good. Glad we had that talk.
All right.
What the hell was I talking about before? It's pretty good.
I have no idea, but
good talk.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, listen, let's end it with me giving your bio again. Kenny Main is an anchor for the 11 p.m. Sports Center. He is now, as he mentioned at the top.
Except when he's doing the 1 a.m.
Right, except he's doing the. Right, but he's now cross country because he has children, obviously, in Seattle. So he's bi-coastal, which has to take a lot on the body. But he's now based both in Bristol, Connecticut, or Connecticut, whatever, the suburbs of Connecticut, and the great city of Seattle. He has a lot of dates on SportsCenter, and included in his contract, we learned he does the he has to do the upfronts.
Wants to.
Like, wants to. I take that back. And he's a huge fan of Dick's Sporting Goods as well as other ESPN sponsors.
Sports where I pay cash only. I just, you know what though? I went to buy an American football. I said, I want to. Do you guys have a real football to the people at Dick's? God love them. They knew what I meant, but they didn't have one. So Gretchen for my birthday ordered me. A real football has the commissioner's signature, just for you people out there that don't know. Like, I should have a real football at each house. I still like to throw. I'm planning a couple flag events coming up. That's beyond my resume, too. One is in Seattle, the 16th. It's the Crohn's colitis event. It's nationwide. Mike McCready of Pearl Jam suffers from that, so he puts on this big flag tournament. I get to play on the team Pearl Jam, which is fun.
That's awesome.
And then I'm playing with the Wounded Warriors, so I'm not anti-military, even though I support people's civil rights stance. Yeah.
By the way, who would Gretchen's favorite SportsCenter anchor be other than yourself? Does she have one?
Probably Neil.
Neil Everett, who, by the way, has a reputation of being a very good guy.
Neil's a solid guy. He doesn't do Twitter. I think he's waiting for somebody to give him $1 million to do Twitter or something like
that. Maybe waiting a while.
I don't know what's going to happen.
Might be waiting
a while.
I'll tell
you what's funny. This thing, does this have any time limit, this thing we're doing?
No, Kenny. It's a podcast.
You
can go on forever.
Well, I'm about to. I find it funny on Twitter. Like, sometimes I'll do a commercial or a promotion for the company or some other company, and part of the package will be, we want you to do 3 mentions on Twitter, you know, like put out the product, which I would have done anyway. Like, if I'm in a commercial, why wouldn't I? Hey, guess what? I'm now selling Hostess Ho-Hos, the delicious snack treat for kids after school. Like, that could be that's the whole commercial right there. But it often doesn't work. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes people see it, oh, that was a funny video, I'll repeat it. But I feel like oftentimes people are like, dude, we already know you got paid to do this stupid thing. I'm not going to retweet it, all right? If you say free Tom Brady, I'll retweet the hell out of that. But I think a lot of people are savvy about what Twitter's being used for. You know what I'm saying? If you're Justin Bieber, if you're whoever the hell has a big fan base and 90 million followers, right?
Right.
People will just hit the button, yes, because they love him. They worship him or whoever that person is. But if you're just Joe Citizen trying to make a buck, do you know where I'm going with this at all? Because I don't. I started down a pretty good path, and I took.
Well, no, I think, I mean, social media can be used for a lot of things, including pretty ugly, manipulative stuff. I don't think there's any doubt about
True.
That, right?
I'm just trying to sell products and help the economy.
I mean, you're the Gary Johnson, I guess, of this podcast, or something to that effect. I'm trying to think of an obscure politician.
It matters. Like, stuff costs money. It's funny when people put down the capitalist nature of different companies, like, they're just in it for the money. Look at them having stuff sponsored, those guys, you know. It's like, well, how in the hell do you think all the salaries get paid? How do the lights turn on? Because they have to have revenue to pay for it because they have expenses. So you get revenue minus expenses. There you go. That's how it works.
Now this has become like an accounting podcast. I love that.
Well, no, indeed, sometimes I will agree. You know, it's a little much, like the guys in the middle of a touchdown run. This touchdown run brought to you by such and such. You know, like, that would be too far to, like, but it wouldn't be. Of course they'd do it if they could. I think I just read, I don't know if it's all the channels or one in particular, is going to do, like, 5-second commercials. So maybe that's the way they're going to do it. Like, literally a guy's running for a touchdown, and they'll have the ability to hit a button, this 80-yard touchdown run brought to you by blank. You know, like, maybe it'll come to that. But as long as it doesn't interfere with how the content is fully being presented, I see no problem with companies trying to make a dollar. That's kind of the point of being in business, I think. So,
yeah.
And I love, personally, making commercials is fun as hell. It's way more fun than our regular job because they usually have free Coca-Cola waiting for you and they treat you like you're important. And, you know, so already you're like, you know, feel like $1 million walking in. But no, the room to do what you do and just the different experience. It's absolutely a blast. Everybody there has always, all of us Sports Center people, whenever we hear of, oh, you get to be nominated for the such and such deal, or so and so called interested in you, like, that's always a little thrill. It's like a bonus upon what you already do, which we already work pretty hard doing that.
Yeah,
so
it's nice.
Getting to do those bonus things is like a nice treat added to a pretty fun job to begin with.
Yeah, that's it's a nice way to make cash as well, off of the sort of the Sports Center proper, which is.
I just do it for the art.
That's big. Thank you, Van Gogh. All right, Kenny Mayne. You've heard so much from him at this
point. Oh, you were trying to go through the resume. You forgot all the right stuff.
Yeah, I was basically trying to kick you out here. So Kenny Mayne, he hosts the 11 p.m. Sports Center, as he mentioned. He sometimes does later as well. He's now back in Bristol, but also bi-coastal in Seattle. Yep. And he'll be on the air for a number of years. And a lot of fans are happy that he's back and part of the regular Sports Center rotation. Kenny, this we've been talking about this for such a long time, and we have finally done it. So I appreciate you coming on today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me, and everyone should go sign up for cable. It's get a hold of your local cable get a hold of them. It's not very expensive. You get a wide variety of channels every month, ESPN and ESPN2 News and you Classic. All of it.
And by the way, best of luck to Gretchen and best of luck to you and Gretchen, but Gretchen specifically.
She's the greatest thing ever. So I try to treat her well. She's a good one.
All right, we're happy for you both. Thank you very much, Kenny.
All right, see you.
Hey, this is Richard Deitch. And before we get to the Ed Cunningham interview, Kenny Mayne sent over a note after our interview concluded. I'm out of the podcast studio now, but taping this. And asked if he could add a footnote. I read what he wrote, and I thought it was fair and transparent. So here you go. Kenny is talking about a section where he said he plays flag football with wounded warriors, and look at me, I'm so pro-military. And he obviously is making a comment here that's meant to be light about the way in which we are all judged for stances on things. And so what he wanted to sort of at least clarify for the record is that he's involved in several what would be described as pro-military, not pro-war, but pro-military organizations, and most of those efforts have to do with helping soldiers return from war. He lost his nephew after Iraq. His nephew is Kyle Farr of the U.S. Army. And so he plays flag football. While it's not a Wounded Warriors official flag football league, there are some warriors who have been wounded who play in that. The next game they're playing is Boston, I think, on Veterans Day. So there you have it. That's a sort of an ad and an addendum from Kenny Mayne, and I appreciate, again, his time.
Okay, my thanks to Kenny Mayne. That, by the way, is an interview that had no beginning, middle, or end, but that's exactly what I expected from Kenny Mayne. And we now have a second guest on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and somebody I really appreciate taking the time today to talk to me, because it was a really important story in the New York Times a couple days ago, and that is Ed Cunningham. You know him from his work as an analyst on college football for ABC and ESPN for many years, and he decided in the spring to essentially resign from that position in what he said is taking full ownership of his alignment with the sport, and he can no longer be a cheerleader for the sport given what has happened with so many football players and health concerns. And Ed Cunningham now joins us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I would obviously recommend everybody who's listening to this check out the New York Times piece from August 30th. But first off, when did you know that you were going to walk away from being a college football analyst?
It was the day all the people were let go, when colleagues were let go. I think that was, well, you'd know better than I, because you follow this stuff. I think it was in April.
Yep.
When Disney had sent down, they needed some cuts. And so the personnel who went this time, the last couple waves of layoffs at ESPN were a lot of executives. And this one was on-air people and a colleague of mine, Dr. Jerry Punch,
you know, a lot of people that I've worked with and known essentially my whole professional life in some regard. You know, I kind of feel like I started in broadcast TV right out of the NFL. So it was 1997. So I've been in this world a real long time. And I just, I literally went and got my morning coffee, and I'm on the West Coast. I drive back to my driveway. I'm about to go in. I have an office off the house, and I'm about to go to my office to get to work, and I see the story that, you know, 100 of my colleagues are gone, and I'm getting texts, and one of them was from a boss that said, "Hey, man, you're good. Weird day for us. Call me at the end of the day, and we'll catch up." So, you know, they were, you know, trying to be conscious of people getting this news because, you know, it was leaked, and they didn't you know, it's a very personal thing for all of us. So I sat in my driveway almost the whole day. It was about 3:30 in my time before I got off the phone with my last call. I called my best friend. I called, you know, people I've worked with for years. I called Mike Patrick, my longtime partner and great friend, who is a combination person and broadcaster, the best I've ever been with. As a partner, and that's, I've been with many, many of the best, you know, but Mike was just a really special partner for me to have the last, I think we were together 6 years. So I called him before I left. And the big thing for me, Richard, was I was sitting in my seat and thinking two things here. Number one, I'm losing my love of the job. Like I just know it. It's been kind of going away for a long time. And that job, being in that, what I, you know, term the cheerleader spot, which is, it's the color analyst. It is the, it's the biggest megaphone for the sport. You know, we talk to, you know, 2 to 3 to sometimes 5 million people per broadcast real time. And our words really mattered. And I took that to heart, and I started to have the conflict of, you know, and I was sort of known as a guy who got after safety, and I really educated myself. I went and at the behest of my boss and being available with all the officials wanting us to understand it, I went and studied officiating. I officiated spring games at Nebraska and Oregon in uniform as an official. And this was not just to learn about safety, but just to get better at my job. I liked it. And that was starting to go away. And it was because I just having a hard time with what I know and what is kind of, you know, a scary thing for all ex-players that played, you know, a good amount of time into the NFL. And I had a 5-year career with, you know, 49 or 50 starts. And that's a lot of ball when you go back to high school and college and all that. And I, at that afternoon at 3:30, I called my boss and I resigned the same day that all those folks were let go. I couldn't in good conscience, knowing that this was in my soul, I couldn't keep my seat. I couldn't let someone else not have that job, if that makes sense. Hmm.
Could you have made this decision, Ed, if you did not have sort of other means? You've been part of some filmmaking. You've done things away from being just a college football analyst or just being a sports broadcaster. How much, if at all, did that factor into you being able to walk away?
Oh, quite a bit. You know, that's I've always sort of had a plan for what's next. Football has always been a huge part of my life, but not the only part of my life. I've been at producing. I actually was a professional producer before I was a professional football player. The very first thing I produced was the national championship video for the Washington Huskies in 1991. Hmm. I did that before I became an NFL player. So I've always been, had things going. So absolutely, Richard, you know, I have 2 young sons, and that's, as we know, a real cost. And so, yeah. And I think not owning that and saying, hey, you know, I've been sort of planning for this, I think, for a while. I've done it 20 years on the button of over the air broadcast commenting, which is pretty cool, you know, no gold watch, but, that was part of it too. It kind of felt like I'd been on that canoe ride, you know, and it was time to continue to evolve as a storyteller. That's the part, is I'm not going away. I'm producing. I write a lot now. I'll probably direct things in the future. I'm completely open to doing more things on camera, hosting, and almost all of it around sports, around the culture of sports. But yeah, having a second career, which I've had now, I've been an active producer for over a decade now, with my own company. That was a big part of it. And here's the kind of part that I like to turn it towards is football, and many of the football coaches I have, and one specifically, Don James from the University of Washington, instilled that in me, gave me that ability to be smart and be a problem solver and know the third and eighth coming up and you got to have a plan. And so I'm also, in many ways, I'm more aligned now that I've sort of taken ownership of how I really feel. I'm more aligned with all of the great stuff I get and will continue to get from football. It's really kind of clarified my relationship in a way with something that's been, you know, at times I've been, you know, sort of didn't want to talk about that much. You know, we made a film, Undefeated, that won an Academy Award. I said no. I didn't want to do it at first because I sort of got my football fill for ESPN. And boy, am I glad I did that. You know, what a great experience. And not because of the Oscar, because it was a great story. It was worthy of telling. So I'm going to continue to tell stories and be around sports and football specifically. But yeah, that's what's neat for me is it is a full circle. I'm tough, resilient, and a problem solver a lot because I played and coached and broadcast this game for a really long time.
I think the question that I most wanted to ask you when I knew I was going to talk to you today is this, and that is how much do you think you will be a broadcasting outlier versus your decision maybe being the beginning of other sports broadcasters who do football walking away?
Well, that's the unanswerable, right? I mean, my intent is that my only intent here was to be a part of a conversation that's already started. You know, I get it. I'm the first one to walk away, and I, you know, I was in good standing. I my job was in place, and I was going right back to work with Mike. I mean, literally, they inserted Tommy Tuberville, and off they went. And they'll probably be better for it, frankly. Tommy, I think, will be incredible at this job. And you know, Richard, it's actually the reason I made this choice is for a person like Tommy Tuberville to take that position because he wants to do it. He does know about safety. He has coached safety. I've talked to him about this stuff. So, you know, I feel good about that ultimately. So, you know, for me, it was about a personal choice. And if other folks start to say, well, you know, look at it differently, that was the intent. What they choose to do, Todd Blackledge, who I really like and respect, and I would say is really the guy that I probably watched and listened to the most to work on becoming a better analyst. I think he's sort of top of the game in our business. And a colleague, we worked some games together at CBS, and then, of course, at ABC, we didn't work together, but saw each other quite frequently. You know, I saw he made some comments to a Canton paper that he disagreed and that he didn't feel that way. And that's completely, that's valid. No judgment. I was really happy to read his comments and at least have him express that because that was the idea. Let's just continue the conversation.
I didn't see that. Actually, I want to check that out. I'm interested because this podcast does a lot about process and how the story eventually ended up with John Branch and the New York Times. Did you and or your representatives contact the Times? Do you know John Branch personally? Obviously, that would be a important publication to get this story out, and given its circulation, its seriousness, its respect, but. You know, clearly that wasn't an accident, and so I'm wondering what was the process of how that story got to the Times.
Yeah. You know what? Can I share something no one has heard before?
Of course, please.
So I kept and still have a file of every game since 2010. I just started our spotting chart. I think you've probably been in the booth and seen with announcers. We just make a big cheat sheet with everybody's names, numbers, stories, blah blah blah. And so I kept those. Actually, I kept from the first game I worked with Mike Patrick because I was just so impressed and I was hoping I could work with him the next year. So I started the file there. And next to it I had a black, I don't even know what it's made of, sports coat that I bought in 2001 when I was first, it was my second season at ABC and I was working with Sean McDonough. And before our first game, I bought this black sports coat from Ralph Lauren, I think. It was, you know, I got it at one of those Ross Dress for Less. Just thinking, oh, if I need it, I'll always have it in my travel bag if I forget my suit coat. Well, I made a choice in 2001 to see if I could wear that coat every time I was on the air with ABC and ESPN. And I did. And I never told anybody that until just recently. So I wore the same black sports coat for every broadcast I ever called for ABC or ESPN. And I don't even know how many. I try to do the math. But that black sports coat became the thing for me that said, doesn't matter what you wear, it matters what you say, and that you have done the research to say it. If you're of substance, no one will care that you're wearing the same black sports coat. You know, of course, I changed my tie and my shirt and all that. So I was literally mothballing that box. That was my college football life, my files and my black sports coat, you know, that went 17 years on air. And that was on studio. I wore that next to John Saunders. This was like a cool thing. I shared it with my boss, and he laughed, and he called it the Hall of Fame jacket. And so I called a pal of mine, and I'm like, you know what, man? I got this black jacket. And it's almost like my muse. And I'm mothballing it. This stuff's going away from my career. I'm going to put it in a box with like all my old jerseys, you know? And, I'm like, I don't know. And he knew the story. I shared it with a few people. And he kind of confronted me and he said, is your story really about the black jacket or is your story about being about substance? I was like, yeah, that's what I want to be known for, just at least saying what I feel and how I feel and also being educated in what I'm saying. And my friend who knows me as well as anyone in the world said, you know, the story here, Ed, is that you're choosing to leave arguably one of the best jobs in America because of true ethical concerns. And this is a guy who is an athlete a former athlete. And he said, you know, stay in your lane and maybe say something about how you feel about safety in amateur sports. You know, choose to speak up. But if you do it, have something to say, right? So this stupid black jacket that I wore on every broadcast for ABC was just the kind of muse to say, okay, I do have something to say. I'm in no way, shape, or form looking to tear anything down. I just want to be a part of the conversation, say something of substance, and hopefully be someone seen as having some principle at a time when there's real conversations and there's real concerns about something that is football, a real important threat, especially for many of us, to not just some sport. It's a threat of our culture. And so it was this dumb black jacket that I'd worn that was just going to go away and no one was ever going to know about it. Just my own little thing that I was of substance. And it was my friend who pushed me and knows me and has been around athletics his whole life. And he said, look, share the story of how you feel and have something to say. And so that's what I did. And then to the point of the process of getting to John Branch, I was not going to do this without a plan. I was not going to do this without sort of running through unintended consequences and also how to say it and say it in a way that's constructive, not destructive, because that's the intent. And so I did hire a professional publicist, someone who does this stuff, a communications director, and worked very hard. You know, we went back and forth, and the decision was to, he knew John Branch of the New York Times, and John has done just countless articles, and he wrote a book about a hockey enforcer who committed suicide around CTE and brain issues.
Right.
And so I read John a bunch. I'm a producer. I like his writing style, so that mattered to me. But his writing is very direct. It's very sparse and it says the things that matter. And I'm thankful I did. I think John really captured how I feel And also, you know, opened up the conversation of, should we hear this? You know, he went to Al Michaels and Al said sort of F Ed, and that's fine because that's what this conversation is about. And again, my intent here is that Al got to have the conversation and he doesn't have to feel like I feel because it's how I feel. And so that's the process that I went through to get to the place where A, I was ready to share it. B, I was ready to put some meaning behind it. C, I put a ton of thought and effort and research before I even spoke. And then, you know, getting to the right place, I think, helped. And then, you know, finally to the New York Times. We sort of started there for the biggest reason is, you know, whether people think it's, well, people have their opinion what the New York Times is, but it does, when it shows up in the feed that we live in, get clicked on. And, you know, Richard, if you're going to say something, and you know this, you have a podcast that goes across to millions of people, if you're going to say it, you know, sort of choose the right platform, and that felt like the right platform as well.
Millions may be a stretch, Ed, but I hear what you're saying. I want to sort of end with two things here. First off is how worried are you, if at all, that you will really miss it, or that you come to the realization that you made this decision more out of emotion than anything else?
Oh man, that's it's funny as you say that, I feel emotional. So, I mean, I'll be, you know, yeah, I think maybe part of this was emotion, you know, and I think that's okay. You know, I try not to make a rash decision, if that makes sense. I really did talk this. I talked at depth with my boss, especially at ESPN, before talking to John.
Which boss is that specifically?
Oh, I spoke with Ed Placey quite a bit. I also spoke with Lee Fitting quite a bit as well. Yeah. Both those guys have been my direct bosses for kind of as long as, well, Ed since the beginning of my tenure at ESPN, and then Lee. So those two guys, and couldn't, you know, when I called them both back in April or May when there was layoffs, I didn't share my ethical concerns. There was, you know, three pieces of this. I do have a young family, and I really do want to just kind of spend time with kids on weekends, you know, and fall and Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's and all that to give up is pretty steep territory with young kids. So that was a piece of this. I shared that. I also shared, you know, I have been sort of holding the reins back a bit as a producer. I have a lot of hay in the barn that I wouldn't be able to travel that much away from the office. If I let it go, if that makes sense. And then I didn't share the ethical concerns with them until I started the kind of process of should I, and if I do, why and how and to whom of the process. So I talked to Lee and Ed before that. They've been amazing bosses. ESPN for me has been a huge growth opportunity, both personally and professionally. I have lifelong relationships. I think there probably was there was a big emotional element to this, for sure. What I try to do is not make a rash decision, and I worked it. You know, I talked to the people I like and trust, got their feedback. You know, Ed Placey's been a great guy. I mean, we debated a bunch. You know, I shared with him, you know, some of the safety things I laid out with the New York Times that I've talked about. And he knows the sport. You know, he's been a producer. He's been a coordinated producer. And we hashed it out. You know, we kind of went back and forth. And that's been the relationship I've, you know, worked on with Ed Placey for a long time. He's a really terrific boss. And so, yeah, there was a lot of emotion. But I made sure I talked to everyone. I made sure we were, you know, I checked myself. I was going to make a big choice. I think it ultimately was emotional.
I know you talked to some people in Iowa about this as well. So I want to sort of finish up on this because it's pretty interesting to me that how much did the your perception of Iowa football's handling of C.J. Beathard during the Outback Bowl, like, bring you to the point where you really decided that this was something that you really could or had to walk away from. In reading up on this and just hearing now you on the podcast, it seems like it's a clear process, but I do wonder if that game in particular, if anything could sort of be called the fault line where you went from one place to another, was that it?
I think it was like the one step before the leap, if that makes sense.
Right.
Like, and I, you know, I've kind of, I don't know, you know the film Usual Suspects?
Of course.
Yeah, so I think my Usual Suspects moment was the Yahoo News feed that my colleagues were getting laid off, right? Because that was the where I sort of had to see what I'd been seeing and reckon what I'd been seeing. And my next data point back to literally the battlefield. And, you know, it's weird because football, it's so American because it is set up exactly like war, right? It really is set up that way. And what I was starting to realize is, you know, I used to think, oh, we shouldn't conflate war and football, and we still shouldn't. However, I had teammates killing themselves. I know of a bunch of my former teammates in the NFL. Well, not a bunch. I know a few of my former teammates in the NFL who are really struggling right now. And, you know, that's very real, man. And when I, my next data point back to that cheerleader spot, that job as a color analyst, and again, I want to be really specific. I'm still going to be telling stories around this game. I mean, a bunch of my next projects are in and around sports and competition, and some directly football. So I'm not stepping away from the fire, so to speak. I just, that position where CJ Beathard got hurt, man, I want to think early, like second quarter or late first quarter. And Richard, I played sports long enough. All of us have played sports long enough or pulled a hamstring chasing our grandkid to know that when you pull a hamstring up near your buttocks, you need to go put ice on that and start treatment. That's the medical, and I'm not a doctor, but as a former jock who's had those, anybody can tell you that's when you go put ice on it. And then the factors start adding up. It's in a bowl game that, other than the competition and film for the NFL, doesn't matter to C.J. Beathard or Christian McCaffrey or Leonard Fournette, in my opinion. And that the quote-unquote reason you do it is because the young person, the 22 or two, so I think he's 22 at the time, is saying, no, I got to compete, because in his mind, tough guys get drafted into the NFL, right? So it's the whole culture of, what are we doing here? Wait a minute. No, he doesn't have to. And oh, by the way, there are a lot of coaches, including one of the greatest of all time that I played for, Don James at Washington, who would have pulled that player out after one series. And because CJ was also ineffective. You can't throw when you can't push off your lower body or your hips. And he's an athletic guy who obviously couldn't run against a, while, you know, sort of depleted Florida defense. Florida still has four or five deep, really good players at every position. They're in the SEC running around hitting this guy. And so I documented as clearly as I could while trying to keep emotion out of it that I believed Iowa was making a tactical error by keeping him in the game because they had what they determined and I saw in film as a capable backup. And that, in fact, they're not, he's not, no one's helping his cause because he's got to run a 40 in a few months. He's got to go work out at the combine. So you're not helping that cause to the next step. And the final question is, well, what the heck are we doing? What is this? And I am not out to indict any specific coach, any specific player. CJ's dad has publicly disagreed, said, oh, he's a tough guy, let's let him play. I respectfully disagree. And I disagree enough to raise my voice and say that we can't do that. And everyone, you know, it's not, I'm not even talking about the head injury. I'm just talking about the culture that we're playing in that says that C.J. Beathard should have played more than a series, maybe a series and a half after that injury because of all of the reasons we're talking about, including competitive. And that was just, it was the last data point. And that night, man, I was just like, wow, I'm going to go back to my family and come June or July, I'm going to really regret thinking about going back and doing this job again. You know, so that was my last data point. So, but it, you know, it's just it's the culture that I think was the issue, not specifically how C.J. Beathard was handled, if that makes sense.
It does. Final one for me, and that is, since this Time story came out, is there anybody you've heard from, either someone who wanted to just talk to you that you wouldn't have expected, or maybe someone who called you to say, I totally disagree with this, but I'm wondering, in terms of feedback, has anybody reached out who surprised you, and if so, and if you want to share it, who was it, and what did they say?
Rick Meyer.
Oh, wow.
Quarterback, Notre Dame. We played one season together in Seattle. It was actually my last season. It was with the Seahawks. Number came across, and he signed it R. Meyer. And so I texted back. I'm like, of the Rick Meyers? You know, he's a really good guy and was a terrific teammate and friend. We went to a Pearl Jam concert together.
Very Seattle.
We played. So, yeah. So Rick Meyer, and his was, hey, thanks for saying something. Thanks for speaking up. You know, that was cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and this one I think is important because this is sort of the thing I sort of knew I was saying. And it was, I didn't play with Ron Wolfley in the Cardinals, but Ron Wolfley is a guy who played for the Cardinals. He's now their color analyst for their radio broadcasts and does a local radio show in Phoenix. And, you know, his position is what it feels like to me is you are saying I shouldn't do my job. You're saying that I should also take the position that it's unsafe. And so we got, you know, we tussled a little bit on the radio about it. And I've known Ron forever, and I've been on the radio with him forever. So we almost always do that, you know. However, he was pretty bowed up. He was pretty ready to kind of say, hey, dude, you're wrong. And it was a totally fair position, and it was a really great discussion. And what I shared with him was that, you know, I'm not hoping to say that. That's not my intent. I'm just sharing how I feel. You know, my position is I couldn't do that anymore. Ron, I don't sit in judgment of you doing it. That is not my goal here. It's just to be a part of the conversation. And we've actually texted back and forth a couple times since we were on the air, just to sort of, because I texted him. I said, hey, just to be clear, I just want to be in the conversation, you know. So I think that's been one of the, completely fair reaction is, well, you're judging me. And that's not my intent. I can see completely how Ron got there. So it was kind of nice, actually, to kind of, you know, chop it up a bit with someone saying, like, you know, no, dude, I don't agree. and he did. Those are kind of the two, I think, the plus and the – not even the minus, just, you know, the kind of the variation and two ex-players and obviously one who's deep in the media on the commentating side. So that was – it was good to have that, I think.
Ed Cunningham has been an analyst, college football analyst for ESPN for a number of years. If you're a college football fan, you've certainly heard his work. He's also a producer, as he mentioned, on this podcast. And there's pretty extraordinary, at least in my world, piece that ran in the New York Times on August 30th about Ed stepping away from college football as an analyst. And I think we will know what it means, if it means something beyond Ed, a couple, 12 months, 24 months, 36 months from now. Ed, I appreciate you giving me time today. I think it's a really important story. And
thanks, Richard.
And one that, honestly, we're really not going to know the impact of for a number of years. But I admire that you went public to the Times, and I absolutely wish you the best of luck heading forward.
Thank you, Richard. And I appreciate the time and the space to be able to kind of talk through these. You know, these are complex issues, so they sometimes don't fit in kind of the talk, you know, radio space. So be able to sit and kind of talk through this in an open format is refreshing. So thanks for the space.
You got it. Absolutely. Thank you, Ed Cunningham. Thanks for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Kenny Mayne for that conversation, which went to 60 different places, but that's what you'd expect with Kenny Mayne. But I appreciate him giving some really thoughtfulness on where his approach to talking about politics on social media. I just think in his position, that's very, very interesting. And so I appreciate that very much. Ed Cunningham, who was the second guest, again, cannot recommend that story enough in the New York Times, just about why he walked away from college football. And he was honest with it. Doesn't mean he expects everybody to walk away. And there's going to be people who are like, screw you, man. This is your decision, but we're sticking with the game that we love and we're going to call it. So so I appreciate his time. He's always been a thoughtful guy whenever I've dealt with him in covering sports media. And so I appreciate him coming on. Previous podcast guests include Stu Mandel and Seth Davis. They were last week. They talked about The Athletic and what is coming for that publication for them in college football and college basketball, as well as diversity hires. And Stu Mandel took some criticism, probably rightly so, for the lack of people of color on that on his staff. He says that will change. ESPN's Cassidy Hubbard was the podcast before that. Before that was Mitch Albom. And we also have had sports media roundtables. Tom Rinaldi of ESPN, Tim Kawakami of The Athletic, Ian Eagle of CBS Sports. Also, please check out the bonus podcast that I did this week with Jim Miller on his new podcast, Origins, which will examine the history of Curb Your Enthusiasm. We also talked a little ESPN on that, too. For my producer, Lou Pellegrino, for Cadence 13, for Sports Illustrated, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.